Well, good evening to everybody. It's good to see everyone here. We have some visitors, and we appreciate you being here. Know that at least some of our visitors are here due to a loss in the family, and so we are sorry for that reason, but we're happy that you're here. If you will, turn to Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21, and for the next few weeks, we will be staying in the book of Acts. We've been kind of going back and forth a little bit between Acts and some of the epistles, but we will do about one chapter a class, and we'll finish up the book of Acts, and then we'll wrap up some of the remaining epistles that we have from Paul. So in Acts chapter 21, let's remind ourselves of what had just happened in Acts chapter 20. Okay, Paul meets with these Ephesian elders. He had spent all this time with them. And he says, "You'll never see me again." And so that's how it really ends. We look at the very last verse of chapter 20. "Being sorrowful most of all because of the word he had spoken, they would not see his face again." And so then he goes on this journey. And we won't read all these verses, but the first three or four verses we have a lot of detail here about, well, here's where this part of the country was, or here's this port we went to, or we changed ships here. Why would Luke put in that detail here in chapter 21? Right, so Paul is, according to chapter 20, verse 16, is hurrying to get to Jerusalem. And so Luke is describing that journey. And it may also be that he's giving us this detail to show credibility, that let me explain to you how we went on this journey. We'll see in other chapters is very detailed about the voyage. And so then if we drop down to, let's go ahead and go to verse 7. And it says, "We finished the voyage from Tyre. We arrived at Ptolemais. We greeted the brothers, stayed with them for one day." Look at verse 8. "On the next day we departed, came to Caesarea. We entered the house of Philip the evangelist." Now, there are several Philips in the New Testament. Which Philip is this? Okay, Acts 6, Acts 8. So he's one of the seven. Who was also one of the seven that had some connection with Paul? Stephen. So here we have these seven men. Philip, Stephen. And what does Paul do? Maybe not directly, but he certainly was in favor of it. What does Paul do to Stephen? We could say it this way. He was part of the death of Stephen. So here we have Philip, and here's these other men that he's worked closely with, and Stephen is murdered. And now all these years later, who is coming to Philip's house to stay? Yeah, so the guy that killed my friend is coming to my house. I got four unmarried daughters, and sure, come on in. What would it require for Philip to be willing to let Paul come in his house? What attitude or feeling must he have? Okay, well that would certainly help if he has confidence Stephen is in a better place. Yeah, there's a whole lot of forgiveness that's got to be there for Philip to say, sure, come in my house, stay in my house. That's pretty remarkable forgiveness. So then drop down to verse 10, we have this prophet Agabus. And what does this prophet do? What does he physically do before he even talks? Okay, so he takes Paul's belt and binds hands and her feet, and what's his message? Why is he doing that? Okay. And whoever owns this belt, and was there a mystery who owned the belt? Okay, it was Paul's belt. Yeah, whoever owns this belt, Paul, you're going to be restrained, or you're going to be tied up when you get to Jerusalem. So if somebody told you, hey, I'm a prophet, and when you get to Jerusalem, you're going to be in prison, what would our temptation be? Don't go. Right? Now, sometimes people say, oh, well, You know, that would be wrong for Paul to ever go away from trouble. Well, I think we had him let down in a basket, and we even had Jesus at times would escape from a crowd. So it's not wrong to avoid getting hurt. But what is Paul's attitude toward this prophet saying, you are going to be in prison? What's his approach when everybody's saying, don't go? Yeah, Paul said, I'm going to Jerusalem. Now, I may be bound, I may even be killed, but I'm going to Jerusalem. Don't break my heart. And notice verse 14, and since he would not be persuaded, we ceased and said, let the will of the Lord be done. And then they ultimately get to Jerusalem, verse 17. It says, the brothers received us gladly. And on the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Now, who would this James be, most likely? Yeah, probably the brother of Jesus. And so, verse 19, after greeting them, he related one by one the things God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And what was the reaction of these Jewish Christians, including James, in Jerusalem when Paul says, let me tell you, all these things God has done for the Gentiles through me. What's their reaction? They're happy, they're sad, they're mad, what are they? Okay. Yeah, they glorified the Lord. But then we have something kind of strange here. And I'm hoping that y'all can explain this to me. Verse 20, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. So is he talking about just there are thousands of Jews in Jerusalem? Or what's he saying here? Yeah, these are Christians. Now, Jewish background, but these are Christians. So there are thousands of Jewish Christians, and they are zealous for the law. Verse 21, they have been told about you. And what have they been told about Paul? What is it Paul is teaching or doing? Okay. Saying, forget about the old law. So if we see here in verse 21, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. Now, is that true? Is that what Paul was teaching? Was Paul saying, do not circumcise your kids. Do not follow any part of the old law. Is that what Paul was teaching? No. Not what he was teaching. What was Paul teaching about, for example, circumcision? If you want to do it, that's fine. But don't you bind it on somebody. If you bind it on somebody, then we get into that warning, Galatians chapter 1. We just tweak the gospel a little bit and what happens to us? We're cursed. Okay? So, but there's no evidence Paul was telling people, you can't circumcise your kids, you can't, you know, if you want to follow the Sabbath, that's, you can do that. There's no evidence that he was forbidding any of that. He's just saying you can't teach it as binding on people. And so go to verse 21, telling them not to be circumcised, walk according to law. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. So it sounds like, y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like this is James, the other leaders, and they're saying, hey, there are thousands of Jewish Christians and they've heard what you're doing, Paul. What are we going to do? They're going to know you're here. Now, what is Paul's response to that? Yeah, we don't see any, you know, verbal response from Paul, but we see here that in verse 23, do therefore what we tell you. We have four men under vow. Take these men, purify yourself, pay their expenses so they may shave their heads. And what is the reason for doing that? Why do these men want Paul to take these four fellows under vow, pay expenses, do all that? What's the point of that? Okay, let's see. Trevor, what was it? Okay, not opposed to the law, Stan. Okay, they can see him living by the law. Okay. And so thus all will know there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but you yourself also live in observance of the law. And so we'll stop there for a moment, then we'll pick up 25. What do you think about that? So these are the, we might say, the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. And here Paul comes and they say, here's what you got to do. You got to take these men. There's got to be this vow. Everybody's got to see you do this. What do you think about that? Is that smart, not smart, appropriate, inappropriate? Okay, so what Sam's pointed out is we're in a transition time period. The church is in its infancy. And Paul, certainly in other places, will say, I've become a Jew to the Jews, Gentile to Gentiles. So Paul apparently did not object to this because he did it, right? He said, this is what I'll do. What's kind of interesting, verse 25, but as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment. They should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, blood, strangled, sexual immorality. Who took that letter to the Gentiles? Paul. I don't know, it seems kind of odd to me. Here he is, he's back in Jerusalem, and they say, now look, Paul, to the Gentiles, we sent them this letter that says, stay away from this. I just sort of picture Paul going, yeah, you know, I took that letter. I was there in Acts 15, but nothing's recorded of that, but maybe that's just me. But then we have verse 26, Paul took the men, he purified himself. And so what happens in verse 27? Who finds Paul? Jews from Asia. How many, I don't know if they had frequent sailing miles or something back then, but these Jews from Asia, how long have they been tracking Paul? I mean, it's just amazing. And they find him. And so what do they do in verse 27? They stir up the crowd. And where do they find Paul? Physically, where is Paul? He's in the temple. And so they see him there. And they get everybody riled up. Verse 28, men of Israel, help. This is the man who is teaching everyone, everywhere, against the people and the law and this place. Now, what do they mean by this place? The temple. So, it's a pretty strong argument. You're there in the temple and they say, everyone, everywhere, against the law and this place, the temple. And then here's the ultimate thing. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. Now, were you supposed to bring Greeks, non-Jewish folks, into the temple? No. Had he done that? No. Okay. Well, then, did they just make this up and say, I got this great lie to tell about Paul. He brought Greeks into the temple. Or what happened? That guy. Yeah, verse 29, they had seen this Ephesian and they supposed. That is a very, very critical word in the Bible. We think about Naaman, right? He's told, go wash in the river. And he gets all bent out of shape about that because he says, I supposed the prophet would come out and wave his hand or do this or that. And we have John 9 about the blind man. Well, obviously, somebody sinned because he was born blind. And their whole argument was built on that. But to be very careful about presuming things and not knowing if they're really true. Because here they're saying, well, we saw him with somebody and now he's in the temple again, so therefore he must have brought a Greek in. But that was not true. Look at verse 30. How effective were they in this attack against Paul? Okay. Yeah, pretty effective. Then all the city was stirred up. People ran together. They seized Paul, dragged him out of the temple. At once the gates were shut. And if it ended there, we might say, well, maybe they just wanted to have a very calm conversation and say, Now, Paul, don't bring Greeks into the temple. But what is, I think it's verse 31, what does that tell us that their intention was? To kill him. I mean, this was, we found him, he's in the temple, let's kill him. word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. You get the sense maybe this is like 20 or 30 people that are kind of upset, or is this pretty widespread? Pretty widespread. And Paul is in the middle of this. And so, verse 32, he at once, the tribune, took soldiers, centurions, ran down to them. And when the people saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Now, this guy has taken a lot of abuse just in the chapters we've covered. Here you got all these people beating on him, trying to kill him. And we'd say, well, just in the nick of time, the soldiers come. And so, we're the soldiers. We come up on this guy being beaten by all these people screaming at him. And so the first thought in our mind is, let's arrest somebody. Who would that be that we would arrest? The guy being beaten or the guy doing the beating? Yeah, I mean, it's like, all right, arrest that guy there. So they arrest Paul, ordered him to be bound with two chains. And then after they arrest him and bind him with two chains, then they say, who are you? What have you done? It's kind of interesting. And what's the response from the crowd? Because the tribune's trying to figure out, all right, who is this guy? Tell me what crime he's done. And what does the crowd say? Yeah, it's just people shouting. And this tribune says in verse 34, he could not learn the facts because of the uproar. He ordered Paul to be brought into the barracks. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers. Now, why would the soldiers carry Paul? He's a grown man. Why wouldn't he just walk? I mean, these people are fired up. It wasn't just that they were angry. They wanted to kill Paul. They tried to kill Paul. He's got these soldiers. They're still trying to get to Paul. Now, let's put ourselves in Paul's place. And so we've got soldiers. What I picture, I don't know if this is exactly it, but all, you know, they've got him kind of, he's horizontal and they're trying to carry him, get him away from these people. For the mob of the people followed, crying out, away with him. Verse 37, as Paul, the guy who had been beaten, everybody's trying to kill him, was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, may I say something to you? I don't know, if it's me, I'm probably like, I want to get in the barracks, like shut the door, let's get secure, and then let's start talking. But Paul says, hey, I want to ask you a question. And what is the tribune's response, his first response? You speak Greek. Kind of an interesting thing. So why would he ask him that? Yeah, he says, do you know Greek? Verse 38, are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness? So, he was evidently expecting Paul to be this, and it says Egyptian. I think the sense is you're a Jew from Egyptian background and you've got, in essence, these terrorists out there. Aren't you that guy? And Paul says, no. He says, I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, citizen of no obscure city. He's saying, no, you've got me completely mistaken for somebody else. And then what's Paul's request after that? Okay, speak to the people. And what were those people just trying to do to him? Kill it. Even when he's got all these soldiers and he's been arrested and bound, they're still trying to get to him. And Paul says, I want to talk to him. What would prompt Paul to be willing to do that? Love? Okay. It certainly take a lot of love to do that. Was Paul concerned about his Jewish brethren? That's right. He was very concerned about them, willing to give up his own life. And so he says, I want to talk to him. What do you think the Tribune, what's going through his head as he comes on this scene, they're beating Paul, he rescues him, he arrests him, they're still trying to get to Paul, and they're having to carry Paul out, and Paul says, by the way, I'd like to have a few words with them. What do you think that would do to the Tribune? Yeah, he hasn't had much time. He's told everything's going crazy in the temple, and he rushes down there and everything is going crazy in the temple. And he rescues Paul, arrests Paul, and now Paul's saying, I want to talk. I want to talk with these people. And so, says verse 38, I beg you, permit me to speak to the people. And when he had given permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand. Now, we've seen that before when Paul speaks. So I don't know what it is, but he does something with his hand. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, and that's where the cliffhanger is, you know. So we'll cover that in a little bit. But I wanted to get through this pretty quickly because in a lot of our classes, we haven't really had much time to talk about what are the practical lessons. So let's stick with just this chapter right now. If we have time, we'll go back some. But just this chapter, what are some practical lessons for us? Because this was something that happened 2,000 years ago. They spoke a different language, different part of the world. What does that have to do with me? What does that have to do with you? So what are some practical lessons? That's right. The idea of forgiveness. And while Luke doesn't spend much time on it, I don't think it was an accident that he pointed out, oh, by the way, this was Philip, one of the seven here. He pointed that out for some reason. And this is at least a reason for doing that. This idea of forgiveness is so powerful. What we see Philip doing. Now, what do we learn from, particularly from Jesus, if I'm very harsh in my forgiveness of Stan, what does that do between me and God as far as forgiveness? So if I hold Stan to a really high standard, then what should I expect God will do to me? High standard. Now, that's a pretty... It could be a very scary thought, right? If we are holding people to this very high standard and say, yeah, I'll forgive you, but I will never forget this. Or, Stan, twice in a decade. I mean, come on. You don't get twice in a decade. Then it's as if God and Jesus saying, that's okay. But we're going to hold you to that standard. Now, that ought to be frightening to us. And this example of Philip is a remarkable example in forgiveness. To be able to forgive somebody who killed your friend and then invite him to your house, and that's pretty strong. What other practice? Yes, Leonard? Yeah, it certainly is a great example of repentance by Paul. And when we have true repentance, then what confidence do we have about how God forgives us? Yeah, it's not like, well, a little bit of forgiveness or maybe forgiveness. It's complete forgiveness when we have made things right. And so that ought to be very comforting to us. But when we find ourselves, this goes back to what Sam said, there's some little squabble between us and we say, I will never let that go. That's if we say that, then we sure can't complain on the day of judgment when God says, you know, I couldn't let that go either against you. So we have a lot of power in forgiveness. We can certainly make God judge us by a harsher standard if we want. And I can't imagine any of us saying, I think that's a good idea. I want it to be harder to get to heaven. That would not be very smart. What other practical lessons from this chapter? Kevin? Right, and we're going to see on Sunday, we get in chapter 22, he is going to share the gospel. He's going to share his own story of how he was converted. And we'll see what the reaction is to that. So, you know, did Paul have the ability, at least at times, to do miracles? Yeah. We know he had the ability, at least at times. I tend to think probably any time. We just saw that in the previous chapter. Remember, he's a little long-winded, and some guy falls out of a window, and he raises him from the dead. It's pretty powerful. So he could have done a miracle here, but he chose not to. Yeah, and this idea of providence, of not some miraculous event, but maybe a nudging here, a nudging there. And from this kind of bizarre situation where the tribune's able to get to him in time, where does Paul ultimately end up? In Rome. Takes a very odd way to get there, but that may be the providence of God. And in any event, he certainly believed in God's protection. And God said, here's what's going to happen, and be strong, be courageous. We'll see that again. And Paul certainly does that. What other lessons, Trevor? Yeah, so just in case everybody couldn't hear Trevor talking about, sometimes we give up things, even if we have a right to them, so as to remove a barrier between somebody and God. And you know, in America, what do we like to say? You know, my rights. And I've got the right to do this, so I'm going to do it. And that's fine. But not when it comes to God's Word. If there is something that God doesn't care about, and I can give that up because that will help me to convert somebody, then what should I do? But I've got the right to have it, Stan. Why should I give it up? Yeah. And so we may need to start where they are. Somebody might have a misunderstanding. Or we see Paul at Mars Hill. He started where they were. But ultimately, if I have to give something up, I go, yeah, but what a sacrifice. But I don't imagine Jesus is in heaven going, I know exactly what you're going through with that. You know, that's bigger than anything I've ever done. You know, we have to be willing to make sacrifices. And when we think about what Paul did, I mean, I'm just saying that if a crowd of people is beating on me, the last thing I'm wanting to do is talk to them, particularly to help them. Okay? So this is amazing what Paul is doing, and it's an example for us. Any other thoughts? Yes, sir. Yeah, he really is a very impressive guy. And we do have this big gap where we really don't know much about him. But he seems to, when we last see him, and then when we see him again tonight, he's doing the same thing. And so, very impressive guy. Any other thoughts as far as from this chapter? Yeah, Paul certainly made all those sacrifices. And what Sam's pointed out, we need to examine ourselves when we start running into what are relatively small barriers compared to what this guy ran into. Well, I think that we're almost out of time. Any final thoughts? And it can even be outside of this chapter. Kevin? You might have taken a little bitty step. Yeah, he certainly couldn't run very fast from these people that were very eager to get a hold of him. Yeah, there's a big difference in assuming and presuming and actually having facts. And we need to be careful we know the difference. So appreciate everybody's thoughts and comments. And we will be in Acts 22 on Sunday.